coming to you from the Sherpa Chalet at the top of beautiful downtown Mount Podcastia. It's a special episode of Too Many Podcasts. I'm Jim the Podcast Sherpa, and today it's a special episode where I get to speak with people from the entertainment industry. So get yourself an aisle seat, pop up some popcorn, and get a cold drink ready, and sit back. Don't crunch too loud, or else you'll miss the interview from the Sherpa Screening Room. Hey there, Rebels of the Sherpalution. Welcome to the Sherpa Screening Room, a production of Too Many Podcasts. It's me, Jim the Podcast Sherpa. How you doing?
How you doing?
When I do these shows, I have guests that are good, I have guests that are very good, and I have guests that are standouts. I recorded this interview back in February of 2020, and it just kept getting pushed back. I couldn't find a date to schedule it, and now I finally have it out, so I'm really glad, because this guest was a standout. I had so much fun talking with him. His name is Steve Bluestein. He's got a really fascinating story, and it's really interesting. And the poor guy was sick with the flu and still wanted to do the interview. And I edited out a lot of the coughing and sneezing. There's a little bit in there. And I edited out a lot of my laughing. And there's still some of it in there, too. But you get the gist of it once you hear the interview with Steve Bluestein. And before we do hear that interview, just wanted to let you know that today's podcast is being brought to you by Audible. And you can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/Sherpa. There's over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Okay, now with that out of the way, let's listen to the interview that I had with Steve Bluestein. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Sherpa Screening Room. My guest today is a comic, a playwright, and also an author, and we will be discussing his new book, Take My Prostate, Please. So you got to have a sense of humor if you're going to write a book like that. Say a nice hello to Mr. Steve Bluestein.
Hello.
How are you, sir?
I'm as sick as a dog. How are you?
I know the feeling. I'm just getting over being sick myself.
Oh, my God. This is the worst cold I have ever had in my life. But you called, and I crawled out of bed to do the interview. So here I am.
He will be known as the most heroic guest of the show.
The most heroic. I may die right here in the middle of the interview, but it'll be heroic. I'll be heroic.
Okay. This is as long as you take care of all the big questions first, right?
Right. But, you know, just for your listeners to know, this is the worst flu I've ever had in my life, and I had the flu shot. It's body aches and fever and coughing up small throw pillows, and I mean, and it's been a month, and it doesn't seem to be letting up. And I went to the doctors, and he said, yeah, you and 900,000 other people have it, so there's nothing they can do for it. So just wash your hands, people. Wash your hands.
I'll wash my microphone when we're done with the interview, too, just to
please
be on the safe side.
Please.
Now, you've been doing stand-up comedy for about a good 30 years?
Try 40 years. I started in 1971 when there was one comedy club in the United States, and that was the Comedy Store. The Improv had been in New York City, but it was basically a club where the kids from Broadway came after the show, and they got up and sang and danced, and some people did comedy. But it wasn't an exclusive comedy club the way the Comedy Store was. It wasn't until the Comedy Store opened that the Improv switched over to all comedy all the time. And Mitzi Shore created an industry that remains to this day. I mean, every club you go to in the United States today is based on the structure of Mitzi Shore's clubs. And I was right there on the ground floor. I walked into the Comedy Store in 1971. I was an assistant buyer and budget ladies' handbags in the May Company in Los Angeles. And I had 5 minutes worth of material that I had done to my friends in college. And I lived in an apartment building, and Ruben, who was on the Partridge Family, Dave Madden, heard me making people laugh sitting around the pool, and he pulled me aside and he said to me, you could do this professionally, and I'm going to take you up to the Comedy Store. And Dave Madden and Albert Hammond took me up to the Comedy Store. I sat in the audience. I said, oh, I could do that. I've been doing this for years. And the next week I came back with my 5 minutes, And Sammy Shore, who was, you know, the owner of the club at the time, pulled me aside and he said, "You keep coming back, kid. You keep coming back." He said, "You have the sound, the sound." And comedians have a specific sound. It's timing, it's clearness, of punchlines. And Sammy told me I had it. And quite frankly, if Sammy hadn't come up to me and said that night, I would have gone home and gone back to the maid company and never come back again.
What was that first night when you played in front of an audience?
Oh, it was like I had always been there. You know, it was like I was in my living room telling people jokes. It was an exciting time because Barry Levinson hung out there. Craig T. Nelson hung out there. Flip Wilson, Red Fox, Steve Landisberg, Jay Leno, David Letterman, Elaine Boozler. I mean, it was the creme de la creme of the comedy scene at that time. And you have to realize at that time period, there must have been 50 comedians. Today, there are 50,000. My housekeeper can do 20 minutes. You know, so everyone's doing comedy today. Pat Proft was there. Pat, who wrote all the Zucker films, you know, Airplane, Naked Gun, Naked Gun 2.5, all those films. Pat was there and was part of the Comedy Store Players. And Pat and I used to say at that time, you know, we should be writing this down. We should be documenting this. And then we went, no one's going to care. We were right. We should have, and no one wrote it down. And then someone came out with a book called I'm Dying Up Here, who he interviewed all the comedians, but he almost got it right, but he didn't quite get it right. He needed to structure a story with a beginning, middle, and end. And life doesn't have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So he needed to pull elements together and create a story. And then there was that TV series, which I watched one episode of, got completely nauseous, and couldn't watch it again. I think it was also called I'm Dying Up Here, because it was nothing like what it was like. Now, for the audience, they loved it because they didn't know. For those of us who lived it, it was a completely different story.
And I guess you had to deal with touring and, you know, getting more exposure.
Well, touring didn't happen until after we got discovered. I mean, I went from the Comedy Store to the Saharas in Lake Tahoe in like 24 hours. I got a phone call from my agent. They said, "You're opening for Kenny Loggins tomorrow night in Lake Tahoe." And it was like that fast for me. And then I continued to work for years after that, being the opening act for Donna Summer, Barry Manilow, Melissa Manchester, Kenny Loggins, Frankie Valli, Frankie Avalon, Seals and Crofts, Tower of Power. I mean, I worked continuously until the comedy club circuit called. And then I toured as a headliner on the comedy club circuit for years, until I couldn't stand it anymore.
In that meantime, you were also one of the founding members of the Groundlings?
Again, the whole industry is very incestuous. And I mentioned the Comedy Store Players. Well, the original four Comedy Store Players were Gary Austin, Valerie Curtin, Archie Hahn, and Pat Proft. And that night that I went to the Comedy Store, that night, I approached Valerie and I said, "You know, I'm new to this. Are there any, you know, of any classes?" And she said to me, "Gary is starting a workshop. You should talk to him." So I approached Gary, and I said, "I'd like to join your workshop." And I did, and I learned all my improvisational techniques from Gary Austin in that workshop. I learned all the tricks that I use on stage today from Gary Austin. That workshop became the Groundlings. And in my class was Cindy Williams and Lorraine Newman, Terry Garr, Candy Clark, Harrison Ford. They were all in this class that became the Groundlings. And Gary said, "You know, I think we should do a show." And I was in the first show the Groundlings ever put on. I think of the 40 years I've been on stage, the 5 minutes I spent on stage with Archie Hahn and Valerie Curtin and myself was like magic. It was like the three of us had one mind. We were reading each other's mind and just interacting with each other, and it was hysterical. And it's one of my favorite memories of all the years of working. And I've worked quite a bit.
And I can imagine that. I mean, you've got all this talent, and you're surrounded by a room full of talent, too, so it's probably very easy for you to bounce off of each other, kind of like when musicians who are very talented play together.
Did you ever have an interviewer die in the middle of an interview? Yeah, it was. Well, he's exactly right. Jack Sue was in the class, Barney Miller. I actually got to work with Jack Sue. I remember as a child seeing Jack Sue in Flower Drum Song, the movie. And the thought that I was actually on the same level as Jack Sue was amazing to me. It was an amazing time, and it created an amazing institution. I'm going to blow my nose now.
Okay.
I hope people are having dinner. One time in Las Vegas, I got a flu like this, and I was opening for Sha Na Na, and I was so sick I couldn't get out of bed, and they sent a golf cart to my room, and I got on the golf cart. They drove me to the stage. I got off the stage and stood in front of the microphone. The curtain opened. I did my show. The curtain closed. The golf cart came back, picked me up, took me back to my room. But in that particular show, I was so sick, I said to the audience, does anybody have any Vicks? And this woman comes up, approaches the stage with a box of Vicks cough drops, and she hands it to me, and I jump off the stage, and I want to hug her, but she doesn't want to get infected, so she's running away from me, and it was hilarious. It was hilarious. It was good times. Now, but all those hotels are gone now. The only place that I worked that's still there is the MGM and Caesar's Palace.
I guess that's probably a completely different life being a comic in Vegas as opposed to a comic in New York.
They have what we call in Vegas a commercial audience, which means it's an oleo of people of all different kinds from all different places. So that you have to hit a note that everyone can relate to because everyone's from a different place. In New York City, they're all dealing with the same things. The apartments are too expensive and too small. The streets are dirty. The subways are crowded. You know what I'm saying? So you can touch on those subjects, get a bigger response. If you took that and put it in Vegas, you'd get a response, but not as big because the people in Ohio and Florida and Colorado don't know what you're talking about.
So you become more relatable in Vegas.
Right. So you need to find more relatable material for the larger audiences. And conversely, if you did the Vegas material in New York, it would lie flat because, you know, they don't know it, you know, they're not relatable to that.
How much of your writing background did that play into your role as a stand-up?
Well, in the beginning, I walked around with a pad of paper and a tape recorder at all times, writing as much material as I could. But David Brenner said to me, I can't write at a desk. I write standing on my feet. And that really applied to me. I started writing new material on stage in front of a live audience. I would go on stage with a note. It said vacuum cleaner. And then I would start talking to the audience. And I would say, I just got a new vacuum cleaner. And I'd start telling them about the vacuum. And the material would come from there, because under the pressure of needing to get a laugh, you become more creative. 90% of my material is always written on stage.
Okay.
Unlike my books and my plays, which are methodically thought out and plotted and written and rewritten. I have one play, I think I have written it now about 28 times. Being the comic, I know where every laugh should be, and when there isn't one where I want it to be, I rewrite to make sure the laugh is there. So, you know, I was always told that writing is rewriting, and that's the truth.
Then you started writing for TV then, right?
Right.
Now, you worked as a writer on the Brady Bunch Variety Hour?
Do you want
to talk about that a little bit?
Do I have to? My agent sent me up for this. They didn't tell me what it was. They just said, go up, have an interview, it's for a variety show. So I went up for the variety show, and I brought my videotape. I think I'd been on the Tonight Show or the Merv Griffin Show or Mike Douglas. You're going to have fun editing this. And I brought the videotape, and they saw the tape, and they go, God, you're so funny, and do you want to write? And I went, yes, I would love to write. And I said, what show is this? And Carl Kleinschmidt, who was the head writer, said, it's the Brady Bunch Variety Hour. And just as he said that, a little tiny gnat flew in front of my face, and I swiped at it. And Carl thought I was doing the Three Stooges take. And he laughed hysterically, and he said, you're hired. So I wrote the Brady Bunch Variety Hour with Bruce Valanche and Terry Hart, Ronnie Graham, Carl Kleinschmidt, Mike Kagan. Boy, you're a fast Googler. Mike was a great writer and a great guy. Love him. We were all stoned 90% of the time, and you know, and we're all writing "Hi, Honey, I'm Home." It was the most bizarre show. Bruce and I shared an office. It was hilarious. In the middle of the show, I walked in and I said to Carl, "Oh, by the way, I'm having my nose fixed on Friday." And Carl said, "Okay." I said, "So I probably won't be in on Monday, but I'll come in on Tuesday." He said, "All right, fine." I had my nose fixed, and I came in on Tuesday, black and blue, with a face twice the size that it was, and a huge bandage. You know, I didn't know what I was thinking, but across my forehead was this big bandage, and I had written in black magic marker, "Under construction." Florence Henderson, for the next 30 years, every time she would run into me, she would go, "Under construction." She loved that.
And then a few years later, you did your first movie.
They called me Bruce. Johnny Yoon called me up and said, "Would you play a Jewish gangster in my film?" Johnny was an old friend. You know, you're all starting out together, so you're all like a big family. You know, we hung out every night for years together. So Johnny called me up and said, "Would you do the movie?" And I went, "Of course." I didn't even care what the part was or how much it paid. And I did the movie. They called me Bruce. The worst movie ever made in the history of film. So far, I've written the Brady Bunch Variety Hour, which it was voted the fourth worst television series in the history of television. And I said to Bruce Valanche, "We're so unlucky, we can't even get the worst television show. We have to get the fourth worst."
So then you got into writing plays and writing books.
You know, when I got off the road, you know, I'd been on the road for so long, and I couldn't stand it anymore. And the quality of the acts in these comedy clubs just went down and down and down. When I started doing stand-up, I was proud to call myself a comedian. But by the time I'd gotten off the road, like I said, my cleaning woman could do 10 minutes, and everybody was trying to do comedy because they wanted to get noticed. And nobody was really funny, and everybody sounded alike, and they all talked about the same things. And I didn't want to be clumped into that category of comedian. So I got off the road, and I decided to write. And I wrote sitcoms and variety shows. And then when that phase of my career was over, I started writing plays. I wrote seven or eight, I can't remember. You know, we traveled. Again, I had to travel. When the plays went into production, I was on the road with them. And my final, because I'm really retired now, because with this cold, I'll probably be dead by Thursday. I wrote two books, Memoir of a Nobody. And the latest book was called Take My Prostate, Please. And I had been diagnosed with prostate cancer. And as I was going through the process, things would happen to me that only happened to me. Very strange, funny things. So I started documenting it. And so I documented the diagnosis, the surgery, and the after, you know, the recovery. And I ended up with a book that people who had prostate cancer or were about to go through the surgery or spouses or lovers of people with prostate cancer could actually read and know what to expect. And it was very helpful. And that's the most gratifying thing to me, is that people are laughing and they're learning, and they're learning that the diagnosis is not the end.
Comedy also comes out of a place of pain sometimes, because you don't really hear comics doing routines about how wonderful their life is. They're usually some sort of suffering. And I guess with your background and your experience as a comic and knowing about timing and how to write, it probably fell together for you pretty naturally, I'm guessing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just see things differently. You know, I believe there are two types of comedians. There's the intrinsically funny comic who sees life a little differently than everyone else. And then there's the technician who has learned that if he says seven words in a row and stops talking, the audience will laugh. David Brenner, who was a friend, one of those intrinsically funny comedians. David was walking down the street in New York City. A manhole blew up in 25 feet up into the air. David looked up and went, "Heads." That's an intrinsically funny person. So I'm an intrinsically funny person. You can't tell today because I'm dying. I'm an intrinsically funny person, and I just see life differently than other people. For instance, I was coming back from the doctor's and the tire light on my car went on. I started looking for an air pump. And I went to like five different gas stations and no one had an air pump. And I said to myself, they have a mini mart at this gas station. You could cater Thanksgiving for 12 people in this mini mart, but you can't get air for your tire. Who designs a gas station and says, I think an air pump is going to be too expensive to put in, but we need a Slurpee machine? You know, and that started a whole chapter in the book, a very funny chapter.
Memoir of a Nobody is a collection of a lot of short stories, all based on events in your life, and I was kind of skimming through it. I was wondering, could you relate the story of when you had Estelle Harris from Seinfeld and her husband over to your house for dinner?
Estelle had agreed to do a staged reading of one of my plays called Rest in Pieces, and she was truly a lovely person. You know, she's not like an actress. She's like, you know, your Jewish mother. And so I wanted to thank her, so I invited her over to my house for dinner. And it was just one thing after another, starting with I dropped a five-pound bag of rice on the floor, and my dogs came running into the kitchen, and they were fighting me for the rice, and then I put the meat in the crock pot and left, and I forgot to turn it on, so I came home, the meat wasn't cooked, and so I put it in the oven, and then Estelle came, and I didn't put the timer on right, so by the time we had finished talking, I opened the oven, and there was a charcoal briquette in the oven, and then the dogs came out and started circling the dining room table, and they started farting from the rice, and Estelle was, you know, kept saying, it smells like your cow died in here. And it was, you know, just one thing after another. And it ended when suddenly a platter in the kitchen fell off the shelf and smashed into a million pieces on the floor. And she said, what the f*** is that? And I said, it's the dishes. They're committing suicide. And we laughed, and you know, it was a hell of a night. It's a very funny story. I'm not doing it justice because it's too long a story to get all the details out in an interview. You have to buy the book and read it.
There are a lot of stories in that book, a lot of them with celebrities and some just on things that happen in your everyday life as well, I've noticed.
Right. Like I said, I open for all these people, and they're always... I wanted to tell the backstage stories, not the ones that you see on stage. Like Kenny Loggins calls me up and says, you want to go for a steam? And I said, sure. He said, everybody in the band is going, and we're going down the steam room. So I go down to the steam room, and there's Kenny Loggins and the whole band completely stark naked. And I, you know, wear shorts when I shower. I'm so modest. And I had to get undressed in front of all these... with a washcloth, and I can't, and I'm sitting there going, I can't believe I'm sitting here naked with Kenny Loggins. That's the kind of stuff that's in the book that may not sound funny now, but written, it's really funny.
The writing puts it into a little bit better context.
Yeah, it does.
Your newer one, Take My Prostate, Please, that came out in October of last year.
Right.
And like you said, it's really been like a good coping tool for... Are you feeling better now, or things are coming along?
Yeah,
okay?
I mean, I'm fine. So far, knock wood, all the tests are negative, so everything's good. The thing with prostate cancer is early detection. You get it early, it's very survivable. And I was very lucky, and we got it very early. The thing about the book is that my doctor read it. He said it's the best tool that he's read about the experience of having prostate cancer. And so he was going to give his copies to his patients, which I thought was great. You know, I really thought that was great. And of course, the books are available on Amazon. They're published by Bear Manor Media, which is a publisher that my agent found for me. And they're on Amazon, they're on iBook, eBook, Nook, Kindle, Barnes & Noble. If you go to Amazon, you just put my name in and you'll find the book.
What we can do on the show notes, I'll put in links to both books for people who want to check them out.
Oh, that would be great. That would be terrific. Yeah.
You said you're retired.
I am retired. I sold my house in Los Angeles and I've moved to the desert where old show business goes to die. And I've never been so happy in my life. I found this magnificent home. It's 4,000 square feet with a guest house and a swimming pool and a three-car garage. It's what my friends call it, the spa. I'm just so happy here. There's no traffic. And I said, you go to the post office, you're in and out in 3 minutes. It's not like in L.A. when you go to the post office, you have to map out your afternoon.
You've had this obviously incredible career, and you know you have a lot of accomplishments under your belt. When you look back, you wanted people to know about you. What would you want them to be the first thing that they should know?
Well, that's a great question. They should know that I was there from day one with the Comedy Store at the beginning of the comedy era. I was one of the original ones, and that I worked and contributed. And I think I'm most proud of my play, Rest in Pieces, which has had three productions already. It's very close to my heart. It's almost autobiographical. It gets rave reviews wherever it's produced. Also that I care about my friends terribly, and I try to help as many people as I possibly can.
Yeah, well, I guess with your book, Take My Prostate, Please, that will be helping a lot of people and people that you never even knew.
Yeah, that's really very rewarding to me.
So his other book is called Memoir of a Nobody, but I would have to disagree with that. He is a somebody, and he's definitely made his mark in the world of comedy and in writing as well. And check out that book on Amazon along with Take My Prostate, Please. His name is Steve Bluestein. Steve, thank you so much for coming on down to the screening room.
It has been my pleasure, and I promise I'll come back when I'm not congested and coughing and sick like this. I'm usually much perkier.
You were fine. I will hold you to return, though, sir.
All right. I look forward to it. Thanks so much.
Very special thanks to Steve Bluestein for swinging by the screening room at the Sherpa Chalet. The links to his books will be in the show notes. Make sure you follow the show at Sherpalution at Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. You can get this show on your favorite podcast app or visit my website, Sherpalution.com. Please leave a nice review for us on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or Stitcher. Okay, that's it for me. I'm Jim, the podcast Sherpa. I will see you next time. And speaking of amazing stand-ups, let's flip it over to Mr. Bruce, who will show you out the door of the chalet. Viva la Sherpalution, everybody. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Too Many Podcasts. Please disperse. You can go home now. I said you can go home now. Viva la Sherpalution. Viva la Sherpalution. Oh. Yeah, I'll come back now, you hear?